Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. During that time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. I'd like to inform all parties that today's call will be recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the call over to your host, Mr. Benjamin Haynes. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Becca, and thank you all for joining us for today's 2022 U.S. Monkeypox Response Update. We are joined by CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky, HHS Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response Dawn O'Connell, and White House Senior Director for Global Health Security and Biodefense Dr. Raj Punjabi. Following our opening remarks, we will be joined by Dr. Jennifer McQuiston, Incident Manager and Deputy Director of CDC's Division of High Consequence Pathogens and Pathology, and Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, Director of CDC's Division of HIV Prevention. I would now like to turn the call over to Dr. Walensky.
Thank you so much, Ben, and thanks to everyone for being here. Good morning. Today, I'd like to provide an update on CDC's ongoing investigation and response to the current monkeypox outbreak. As of June 9th, over 1,300 cases have been detected globally in 31 countries, and there have been 45 cases of monkeypox identified in the United States across 15 states and the District of Columbia. While cases have continued to increase, I want to reemphasize that there have been no deaths yet associated with this outbreak. Over the past 2 weeks, CDC has continued to increase awareness of monkeypox through close work with our public health partners and clinicians, as well as through outreach and communications across affected communities and the public. All Americans should get educated about this disease, including how to prevent it, its symptoms, and how to get tested. So let's start with what we know about how monkeypox spreads and how to prevent it. Monkeypox spreads through direct contact with bodily fluids or sores on the body of someone who has monkeypox, or with direct contact with materials that have been touched, that have touched these bodily fluids and sores, such as clothing or linens. It may also spread through respiratory secretions when people have close, sustained face-to-face contact. Monkeypox is not thought to linger in the air and is not typically transmitted during short periods of shared airspace. The virus is not thought to spread through interactions such as having a casual conversation, passing in the grocery store, or touching the same items such as a doorknob. We do not yet know whether the virus may be spread through contact with semen or vaginal fluids, or the potential for transmission among people who are infected with monkeypox but have no or mild symptoms. What we do know is that those diagnosed with monkeypox in this current outbreak described close, sustained physical contact with other people who were infected with the virus. This is consistent with what we've seen in prior outbreaks and what we know from decades of studying this virus and closely related viruses. In terms of symptoms, the current outbreak, we have seen presentations of monkeypox that are mild and sometimes only limited areas of the body, which differs from the classic presentation seen in endemic countries in West and Central Africa. This has prompted concern that some cases may go unrecognized or undiagnosed. Historically, people with monkeypox report flu-like symptoms, such as fever, body aches, and swollen glands, before a characteristic, often diffuse rash appears on multiple sites of the body, often on the face, arms, and hands. But during the current outbreak, some patients have developed a localized rash, often around the genitals or anus, before they experience any flu-like symptoms at all, and some have not even developed such flu-like symptoms. Further, in many, the rash doesn't always extend beyond its initial site, or it extends to only a few sites versus around most areas of the body. The rash that develops may look like chickenpox or a sexually transmitted infection, such as herpes, syphilis, or lymphogranuloma venereum. It's important to be aware that monkeypox cases may present similar to some sexually transmitted infections and could be mistaken for other diagnoses. Importantly also is that there have been cases of co-infection with monkeypox and other infections, including syphilis, herpes, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. And for this reason, patients are presenting with symptoms should be evaluated for all STIs in addition to monkeypox And healthcare providers should not rule out monkeypox just because a patient has another diagnosis or another STI. So I encourage all healthcare providers to review the updated information on the current monkeypox outbreak. Resources are available, including updated photos from CDC on our website and from local public health departments. I also want to stress that anyone who has symptoms of monkeypox, such as rashes or lesions which may appear as pimples or blisters, should talk to their healthcare provider. While the overall risk of monkeypox in the United States public is currently low, we do want people to be aware of the signs and symptoms and to seek care right away if they think they might have monkeypox symptoms. We've updated our website, as I noted, with new photos, along with the latest case information, and this is, of course, updated daily. Finally, we have laboratories across the country that can test for orthopox, the family of viruses that includes monkeypox. There are 69 labs that are part of our Laboratory Response Network, or LRN, that have been able to immediately begin testing for suspected monkeypox cases using an FDA-cleared orthopox virus test. While we currently have plenty of testing capacity within our LRN, we are also actively, proactively working with FDA and CMS to explore how we may further expand this capacity, both within the public health labs that are part of the LRN, as well as with commercial laboratories that are accessible across the country. To best characterize this outbreak and to achieve our goal of bringing it to an end, we must increase testing for those with a characteristic, again, pimple-like or blister-like rash, so that we can make swift diagnoses. As we closely monitor and respond to this outbreak, CDC will continue to provide the latest information on what we know and when we know it. Our priority is to help everyone make informed decisions to protect their health and the health of their community. Thank you very much. I will now turn things over to Ms. O'Connell.
Thanks so much, Rochelle, and good afternoon, everyone. The Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, or ASPR, continues to work closely with our CDC and White House colleagues on the monkeypox response. We are also working closely with our state and local partners on their request for the vaccines and therapeutics needed to treat those infected by or exposed to monkeypox. For years, we've been working with federal and industry partners to make sure we have the tools we need to respond to moments like the one we're in now. Our Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, has supported development and procured vaccines such as Jynneos to prevent smallpox and monkeypox, as well as smallpox treatments such as TPOX, which is an antiviral that can be used for monkeypox. In addition, the Strategic National Stockpile, or the SNS, supported development of ACAM2000, a vaccine which is FDA approved to prevent smallpox, but can also be used under an appropriate regulatory mechanism to vaccinate at-risk individuals for monkeypox. The SNS holds enough vaccine, both Jynneos and ACAM2000, to vaccinate millions of Americans if needed. This includes more than 100 million doses of ACAM2000 available for vaccination against monkeypox. The SNS now holds about 72,000 doses of Jynneos in its immediate inventory, and we will soon receive an additional 300,000 doses from the manufacturer, Bavarian Nordic, over the course of the next several weeks. The company is also holding over 1 million additional fully filled and finished doses owned by the U.S. government. Further, in order to ensure we have enough vaccine for a variety of scenarios, today we announced an order of 500,000 liquid frozen Jynneos doses to be filled and finished from existing bulk vaccine. The additional doses will be delivered to us later this year. The U.S. government owns an additional 15.9 million doses in bulk drug substance that can also be filled and finished at our request, should they be needed. We are working with state health departments and the CDC to distribute vaccines and treatments where appropriate. To date, we have supported 16 states and jurisdictions. While we need to remain vigilant and seek to contain the spread of monkeypox, we have the vaccines and treatments we need to respond. Thank you, and with that, I'll pass it to Dr. Punjabi.
Well, thank you, Don, and thank you, Rochelle. My name is Raj Punjabi. I'm a physician and epidemiologist, and I lead the Pandemic Preparedness Office here at the White House. My office oversees the U.S. government's effort to prevent and respond to infectious diseases, including monkeypox. I want to start by just making very clear, we have the tools to protect people from this disease. We have tests for monkeypox, we have vaccines for monkeypox, and we have treatments for monkeypox. We have a multi-pronged approach to deploy those tools to ensure we're fighting this outbreak as effectively as possible. We want to test infected individuals to find out who's ill. We want to isolate and care for anyone who's suffering from the disease. We want to understand who's at risk of developing monkeypox through contact tracing. And lastly, we want to offer vaccines to people who've had high-risk contact with infected individuals to help prevent onward transmission. To assess how we're doing in this response, I previously have spoken about the three primary indicators, what I call the three T's, that we're using to assess the effectiveness of the response to the outbreak. The first T is testing. To date, over 300 PCR orthopox tests have been performed. We've seen more than 45% increase in week-on-week testing. And our national network of public health labs, as Dr. Walensky was describing, has spare capacity to conduct over 1,000 tests per day. We are working to make testing more through public health labs more convenient and expand testing beyond public health labs through commercial partners. But testing can only happen when people with symptoms seek care. And that's why we're speaking to community leaders, healthcare providers, and you, the media, to educate the American public on monkeypox so they know what to look for and clinicians know what to test for. So I just want to reiterate Dr. Walensky's message. Anyone who has symptoms of monkeypox should talk to their healthcare provider and seek testing. The second area of performance we're looking at is tracing contacts. State and local health departments, as you know, are carrying out contact tracing. The reason that is vital in this epidemic is because that allows us to monitor for symptoms amongst those individuals who've been exposed to someone with monkeypox. And health departments are able to assess an individual's risk of exposure and offer vaccines to those who meet criteria to help prevent the disease and stop it from spreading to others. So that's the second T, tracing contacts. The third T is timely access to vaccines and treatments. We want to ensure that people with high-risk exposures have rapid access to vaccines, and if they become sick, that they can receive appropriate treatment. You heard from Don about the stockpile numbers. Let me also share what we've delivered to date through ASPR and CDC. We've delivered over 1,400 vaccine courses and over 110 treatment courses to affected state and local jurisdictions. And as Don said, we have more to offer states. Thankfully, until now, we have not seen any reported monkeypox-related deaths. We'll continue to work to make sure that our local and state healthcare providers are well-equipped with these tools, the vaccine, the tests, the treatments, so that we can effectively contain this outbreak. Thank you again for joining us, and we look forward to taking your questions.
Thank you to each of our speakers. Becca, we are ready to take questions.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and clearly record your first and last name for your question to be introduced. Again, that is star 1. Our first question comes from Courtney Bubble from the Government Executive. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you so much for doing this call. Just a quick question. Last week you said you couldn't give numbers on vaccines and, you know, the distribution, but then there was a blog post this week that gave those numbers, and then you also just went over them now. So can you tell me, I guess, what the difference was? You know, last week you cited security concerns for not giving the numbers, but now you're able to give them?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the question. This is Dawn. So we don't traditionally share what we have in the Strategic National Stockpile for national security reasons. And, we don't need our adversaries to understand what exactly we have available to us to protect the country. And so that's a decision that we sort of have longstanding policy. We have spoken, and we went back and looked after the conversation we had last week, at what we've said about the work we've done on smallpox over the years. And we made a decision in a couple of different ways, one that we've talked very openly about having enough vaccines to be able to vaccinate the American population. So that's something we've said before. And we thought it would help in this case to give just a little more granularity that the number of vaccines is not something the American public needs to worry about, that we do have more than enough. And frankly, if our adversaries heard that, I think that would be a deterrent for them to know, too. So those were decisions that we made. Appreciate the question, and we did want to be as open and transparent in this particular situation because we thought it made sense to do so.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Next question comes from Rachel Gutman from The Atlantic. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you so much for taking questions. I think Dr. Punjabi mentioned that the government has delivered 1,400 vaccine courses to state and local jurisdictions. I'm wondering if you all can offer any more details about how many of those courses were JYNNEOS versus ACAM 2000, and how many of those have actually been administered to patients.
Don, would you like to take that one?
Sure. What I can say is there's been a mix of ACAM and JYNNEOS, but I think a greater preference for JYNNEOS. We are continuing to assess and to work with those that we've given the vaccine to. You know, we're, the SNS is giving them to the states to administer, and we're continuing to work with the states to try to get data back on what has actually been administered. But we are, that's an ongoing process. It would be a new tool that we have to be able to report on, and we're currently working to try to capture that information. Our hope and expectation is that what we have shared has been administered, but we'll have more information on that soon.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Krista Marr with Politico. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you for this. Is the CDC currently working on guidance to expand the range of symptoms that clinicians should look for when they're considering sending a sample to one of the public health labs? And also, our reporting suggests that for other countries to receive supplies of JYNNEOS, it may require the U.S. to agree to some diversion or delay of its assigned doses that are in storage. Is the U.S. considering that, and can you share any details? Thank you.
Maybe I'll start with the first question, and I would actually, we are deeply engaged in communications to our providers as well as to patients, updating in real time and working closely with them in terms of outreach calls at the public health level, at the clinician level, and at the community level. Dr. McQuiston, I don't know if you want to add more granularity to those points.
Sure, thank you. This is Jennifer McQuiston. We are definitely working to expand information to clinicians so that they know if additional symptoms should trigger thoughts of monkeypox. For example, I think some of the patients that we've seen in the United States have reported a particular symptom called proctitis, which is, I think, a swollen prostate. And I think that that's, for example, a piece of information we want to get out to clinicians to think monkeypox if they see that in association with another characteristic rash illness. So we are working on more extended communications to clinicians that we hope will go out next week, and we've also provided updated information in our case definitions on our website.
And just to be clear, the clinical syndrome of proctitis is sort of pain and inflammation in the lining of the rectum that is painful upon defecation and potentially on sexual activity. So I just want to clarify that. Thank you, Dr. Walensky.
Sorry, Dr. Walensky.
And I can. This is Raj. I can take on the second part of your question about the international approach. So from the very beginning, we know that there's no domestic-only approach to a multinational outbreak. And for several years, the U.S. has been, through its global health security programs that are led by CDC, State Department, USAID, in endemic countries like Nigeria, Democratic Republic of Congo, have had boots on the ground helping train disease detectives, ensuring that response is happening locally. That's been going on for years and years. In the context of this outbreak, we do have a dual goal of both responding effectively to the outbreak here and also assisting countries more to respond to the outbreak globally, especially in endemic countries. Very early on, there some of the Jynneos doses were given back to the bought back by the company, so that that could help the international response. As Don already said, we do have sufficient supply at this time for the U.S. We are also exploring additional options that at this time for further assistance.
Can I just a clarifying question? So, sorry, Jynneos bought back some of the doses that the U.S. had already purchased. Is that right?
Yeah. Don, you could jump in on this one.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Thank you. You know, so we do, to Raj's point, want to be as supportive of our international partners as possible. And the world has Jynneos because we invested in it. We developed it. But we realize how fortunate we are that we've done that and that we've got these doses and have purchased them. Some are being manufactured on a line that still needs to be inspected by FDA. We're expecting that inspection in the next several weeks. And once that inspection has happened and that line has been cleared, we've got several doses that are going to be released for use for us in the U.S. as FDA approved. That line, however, is currently approved by EMA, the European regulator. So it didn't make sense while we were waiting for FDA to get the inspection done, which is coming, that we sit on doses that our international colleagues in Europe could actually use. So there are about 215,000 doses that we've made available to them. We can't give that to them. That's something that we have to sell back to the company. The company has to buy it back from us, and then the company would interact directly with the foreign countries that are interested in that. But we are, you know, supporting that effort, and we thought that made sense right now since those doses really wouldn't be available to us for a few more weeks.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Dan Diamond with Washington Post. Your line is now open.
Good morning. For months at the start of the SARS-CoV-2 outbreak, CDC, other public health agencies denied that COVID could linger in the air. Now CDC acknowledges that airborne transmission is a major COVID risk. We're about a month into this monkeypox outbreak. How confident are you that monkeypox doesn't linger in the air and your other public health assessments at this point? Are there specific recommendations that are most likely to change? And we should think about this as we're covering this early outbreak.
Thank you, Dan. So let me start by saying all of the cases that we have seen to date in this outbreak, as I mentioned, have been related with to direct contact with materials that have touched direct physical contact, either through close physical contact or through bed sheets and whatnot. Nearly all of them through close physical contact. Of course, in those close physical contacts, it's nearly impossible to separate the skin-to-skin contact from the sexual contact from the face-to-face contact as the reason for transmission. Although what I can say is that monkeypox is not thought to linger in the air as we think about the definition of airborne transmission. When we consider airborne transmission at the CDC, we're talking about small viral particles that become suspended in the air and can stay there for long periods of time. We have not seen documentation of that through our experience with this virus or with prior similar viruses. So it really is thought to be transmitted through close face-to-face contact and skin-to-skin contact.
Could I add just one quick thing? This is Raj. Dan, just I think the other confusion that we're seeing sometimes around this issue is what are droplets and what are aerosols. So droplets and aerosols, as we know, are different. Droplets are large moisture particles that fall quickly to the ground, like drops of saliva. Aerosols are much smaller particles that can linger in the air, as Dr. Wilensky was describing. If a virus spreads through aerosols, it's considered quote-unquote airborne. Droplet transmission of monkeypox has been reported, but airborne transmission has not. Hopefully that helps.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Alexander Chen with CBS. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. Following up on what you just told, Dan, can you clarify what mode of transmission explains the cases that aren't linked to that close intimate contact? I think you said it was nearly all, but not all. And then separately, New York had said that they had an orthopox virus case that CDC couldn't confirm as monkeypox specific. Why do you think that happened, and how many more cases are there like that? Thanks so much.
Dr. McQuiston, do you want to go ahead and take sort of the granular details on that? And part of my nearly all, just to be clear, is because we're still doing contact investigation on some of the reported cases. But Dr. McQuiston?
Certainly. I can tell you that of the cases that we have been reported to us that we have information for, everyone reports a type of close contact that could be associated with direct skin-on-skin contact. As Dr. Walensky said earlier, it's often difficult to separate out what a face-to-face droplet transmission might look like compared to direct skin-on-skin contact if people are very intimate and close with one another. But all of our patients have reported direct skin-on-skin contact, perhaps not with a known monkeypox case, but have reported that kind of contact in their history. I can also take the second question. So, yes, CDC early on, New York had a case that they confirmed by orthopox virus testing and sent to CDC for confirmation. It's my understanding that that individual was pretty advanced in their illness and near the end in resolving, and I think when the additional samples were taken, perhaps there wasn't virus that was easily detectable at that time. So in our hands, it read as an inconclusive result. So it remains a probable monkeypox case because it did have a confirmed orthopox test at the LRN lab.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from John Cohen with Science Magazine. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Given the risks of ACAM2000, both to the individual and to people near the person who might acquire the vaccinia, why is, and given that Jynneos is actually FDA approved for monkeypox, why is CDC even distributing ACAM2000 to anyone who requests it? I think there's confusion about that.
Dr. McQuiston, do you want to take that?
Sure. So we're still learning about this outbreak and who's going to most benefit from vaccine. I know that Dawn gave you numbers for the Jynneos supplies that we have right now. I'm sure you can tell from those numbers that we don't have enough Jynneos currently in our supply chain to vaccinate everybody in the United States. So it does require thinking about who would benefit most from Jynneos at this time. And right now, that is high-risk contacts of monkeypox patients. CDC is actively working on developing a vaccination strategy that I think we will be talking about with our partners who are on this call and what that might look like. But ACAM2000 is part of our national stockpile because it is an approved smallpox vaccine, and I think that it does have uses for preventing monkeypox for individuals who are not at risk for adverse events from it. And I think it's going to continue to be part of our conversations as we make those plans.
Becca, we have time for two more questions.
Okay. Our next question comes from Michaeline Duclos. Your line is now open.
Is that Michaeline Duclos? Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call, my question. You said that there's about, 40, 45 cases right now in the U.S. Can you tell us how many of those cases were in contact with another monkeypox case or had international travel, and how many of those cases look like community transmission?
So some of these cases are newly reported, and we're still gathering information on them, so we don't have details for all of those cases. I think that the majority of cases in the United States, so 75% or more, are still reporting an international travel exposure that likely resulted in their monkeypox infections. We also have some individuals who are reporting contact with a known monkeypox case, so are identified through contact tracing and go on to develop infection. And there are some individuals in the United States, it's not many, just a few, who are not sure how they acquired monkeypox. And that might suggest that there is some community transmission happening at levels that are below what's coming to the attention of public health officials. I think CDC is very interested in making sure that we're improving testing among individuals who are presenting with a rash illness precisely for that reason. We want to be sure that individuals with a characteristic rash like monkeypox are coming to the attention of healthcare providers and getting a monkeypox test. And that's how we're going to know if there's community transmission happening.
So can you say anything at all? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's a privacy issue of where those cases are that aren't linked, where the community transmission may be possible.
So it's
from multiple states. It's not one particular area. I can tell you that we don't have an area identified right now in the United States that seems to be having an urban outbreak, like has been reported for Montreal and some other places. We don't have one area where it looks like there's a lot of community transmission happening. There are just these occasional sparse cases that are not sure how they acquired monkeypox. In all likelihood, they acquired it from someone who recently traveled, but they're just not sure. And that's the situation we're in the U.S. right now. This could change. We could start to have community spread, and I think that we need to make sure our testing is increasing and that we're able to catch it when it happens.
And our last question, please.
Our last question comes from Helene Branswell with STAT. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my question. I'm wondering if you all have any data yet on uptake of vaccine in the people it is offered to. You will have noted a couple of weeks ago, or last week, I guess, when Eurosurveillance ran a bunch of reports from Europe on monkeypox outbreaks, the UK HSA said that only 69% of the healthcare workers there and 14% of the contacts accepted vaccine when they were offered it. Do you have comparable data for the U.S.?
Back to my question, do we, or I don't know if Asper wants to take that?
I can start, and then I can turn it over to Asper if that's okay. So right now, we have a lot of individuals who are being traced as contacts. And the decision of whether they're going to accept vaccine when it's offered is a decision between that individual and their provider, and we don't always have immediate insights into what that looks like. As we progress in our data collection about the outcomes for contacts, we hope to start collecting that information so we can get a little more insight. I can tell you from what we know right now, there are some people who are taking vaccine and there are some people who are not. And again, that's a personal decision between the patient and their provider. Dawn, do you want to add any context?
Well, I thought you said it perfectly. You know, we're in the process of figuring out how to get that data back into our system. Right now, we've been very focused on making sure that the vaccine is deployed to where it needs to go, with the hope and expectation that it is being used. But we are in the process now of getting that data back into the system to understand who's used it and how and who isn't using it and why, and that'll inform future decisions that we make about deployments and other things. So, yes, still a work in progress. I hope to have more on this soon.
Well, thank you to all of our speakers, and thank you all for joining us today. If you have further questions, please contact the main media line at 404-639-3286, or you can email media@cdc.gov. Thank you.
Thank you for your participation. That concludes today's call. You may disconnect at this time.